First of all, congratulations on your latest national championship. How you holding up? I would imagine you've been sleeping a lot lately.
Yeah, for sure. Good morning, guys. The funny thing is this week is actually graduation week for us. So it's NCAAs last week. Yeah, and then graduation this week and Curtis Cup flying down and missing grad, unfortunately. But it's been a crazy turnaround, crazy 2 weeks.
How much is it all about time management for you then, between the practicing you have to get in to stay at the elite level that you're at? You're coming off an NCAA championship and now getting ready for the Curtis Cup. That's a lot on your plate.
For sure. I mean, I'm just joking with the girls down here. Like, I'm also finishing up finals, finished my last online final in the hotel room last night. But I think with practicing and recovery, USGA does such a good job, and we're definitely prioritizing that this week.
Kelly, you have 9 match play victories in the NCAAs. That's the most in history. You got more match play now at the Curtis Cup. What's the secret? What's the key to being a strong match play performer?
You know, the one thing I really love about match play that I've had an opportunity to do, especially in NCAAs and with the Curtis Cup, is that it's like for a team, and the motive and goal oriented around producing and bringing your most to the benefit of the team. So I just love that team environment. I think it just gives me that extra, ability to just kind of commit and get the job done.
Speaking of the team, you are the 16th Cardinal to make it to the Curtis Cup, and you're the first since 2022. What does it mean for you to be representing yourself, representing your country, and representing your school?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely no higher honor and privilege to be able to represent your country. And the past 4 years I've been at Stanford, there's also, it just means a lot to wear that S. So I think those two things combined, especially this week being one of the greatest weeks of amateur golf, I think it's super meaningful. I'm soaking it all in, but also just feeling very privileged to be in this position.
Kelly, you're young, but you're a lifer in this game. Go back to 2014. You won the 7-9 girls division of the Drive Chip and Putt National Finals at Augusta National Golf Club. Said it was the best day of your life. How did that moment impact you and your love of this game?
Yeah, looking at these pictures, that was so long ago. It's funny because I've also gotten to play in the AMWA, the Augusta National Women's Amateur, that they have the past 3 years too. So I think a lot of it is super full circle. Obviously, those moments and being able to experience what it was like to compete on a big stage then kind of draw back onto those parallels to those even when I compete now. So I think those giving me the opportunity to see what that looked like and kind of excited me along my journey.
You heard Damon mention at the start of this segment that your team for the United States Curtis Cup team is like murderer's row. What's it like for you to now be a teammate for this week with all of these great players?
Yeah, these girls are so great. I mean, that's hilarious. They're so good at golf. We're playing a couple practice rounds this week, and I just can't stop. Like, the golf fan in me is like, you guys are just so good. Like, I just could watch you guys play all day. So it's amazing. I mean, I think we're ready to have a good week. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, it's interesting to me, like your college teammate, Omega Gane, you have a sister who also plays golf, a younger sister, if I'm not mistaken, Christina at Columbia. So clearly you guys you hit the books as kids. What advice do you give to your younger sister who's chasing her own dreams in this game?
Yeah, she actually, she was a first team Ivy all league this year too. So she kind of handles her own stuff up there in the Northeast. But I think for her, and it's important for like both of us to just be process oriented and not focus on the outcome. Just put as much work in every day. I think, like you mentioned earlier, it's all about time management and putting your time and energy towards things that you think and you hope that will work towards the goal. So, yeah.
Kelly, back to the fun side again. Can you kind of take us behind the curtain and tell us what this week is like in terms of the galas and all that surrounds it?
For sure. I mean, yesterday we were at this, we went down to G4 on Rodeo Drive. So kind of the ultimate LA experience. And then it was super fun. They had us do a little, some photo shoot. just a lot of it. We got Erewhon smoothies. I mean, super LA. And we're all young women, so we just couldn't be having more fun here.
That's awesome.
What are the dinners like? Is it Ivy at the Shore? Is it In-N-Out Burger? I mean, you're from California. Are you showing the folks kind of what it's what a perfect day in LA is like?
Oh my God. We have our opening dinner at the Jonathan Beach Club today. So I actually personally haven't been, but I'm really excited. In-N-Out, I think we, I think they might want to shy away from that just because, you know, ramping up for a big week. But that's a great point. I'll have to take that back to the team.
Kelly, it's awesome that you guys are loose and having fun right now because obviously soon enough the nerves are going to start to kick in because of an event of this stature. We wish you and your team the very, very best and thank you for your time.
For sure. Thank you, guys.
Darren, I hope you're doing well. It was great to see you in the winner's circle again on Sunday. We got to ask the question, though. Mm-hmm. How did you end up hooking up with Ben Crane?
Yeah, Ben and I sort of read off a different sort of script. You know, he's different. But my partner from the previous year when we won our tier, we only play tier one events on the PGA Tour Champions. So it was good to win another one again. But my partner last year was Thomas Bjorn, and he's had back surgery, unfortunately, earlier this year and was hoping to be back sooner rather than later, but unfortunately had a few complications, so couldn't play. So when he pulled out late, most of the pairings and teams had already been decided, so there was very few, guys that were available for me to play, and I was thinking of play or not play or whatever and wait for Thomas to get better and go back next year again. But then my caddy, Keith Nolan, suggested, why don't you try Ben Green, see if Ben would like to play? So give Ben a call, and he was delighted and said yes immediately. So it all worked out for the best.
Yeah, for the best. What do you do now?
Yeah, I mean, one of them reads the New Testament, the other one reads the wine list. So what was what was the gelling like, though? How quickly did you guys bond?
Well, put it this way, I am, due to the fact that I didn't use any really bad language last week, I could double the amount to use this week if the ball doesn't go in the right direction. But you know, Ben plays a little bit deliberately. I play very fast, and Ben doesn't touch alcohol. I prefer to have a little bit now and again, and, you know, very different. But we gelled brilliantly. It was one of those sort of weeks, especially on the Saturday, you know, when we had 17 birdies and shot 54 in a scramble, which is like a once-in-a-lifetime sort of thing, playing a two-man scramble. And, you know, I just hit it and Ben hold the pots, and it was one of those sort of weeks. But we gelled really well, you know. The one thing that we did say was there was no sorries to each other at any stage. We were both trying. Sunday was a tough day for us. Neither of us were really in the rhythm of it. And the course of playing a little bit more tricky. Strick gave us a good tough test there at his tournament last week. And we just sort of had to grind it out. And it's great to win tournaments when you win them pretty. It's also pretty good to win them when you win them having to grind it. You know, winning's what we do it for, but we certainly both had to grind it out on Sunday to actually get it done.
Darren, how have you... That's a great shot there.
He was so excited. I had the camera down all day. He was so excited.
Yeah, it was a breakthrough for him, too. But yes. How have you been able to, how do I phrase this, stay true to your swing? Do you know what I mean? Through all these years, you're coming off another victory. You've mm-hmm. always been who you are with that golf swing. Mm-hmm. It's your fingerprint.
Oh, believe me, I have experimented and gone down the road of many different paths. And, you know, you get down there and the light's not as bright as when you started off, and you got to turn around and come back again. And, you know, I'm obviously an old guy now, and I grew up playing links. So I would refer to myself more of a chest coverer, you know, so I flight the ball lower and playing on links. But, you know, when I'm playing over here, I've got to hit a little bit higher. So I'm always tweaking, and I still work really, really hard at it. And I go down avenues that I shouldn't go down and just stick to the basics, turn hard through it, down hard and left, and hit the ball with my chest and not my hands, not jumping up high left, straight in that left leg like a lot of young kids do. I can't physically do it. Mentally, I don't feel as if I'm 57, and I try and do these stupid things quite frequently, but, you know, I'm back on the path, and I just... You know, you think I'd figure out what works for me and what doesn't work for me by my age, but sometimes I veer off in a tangent here or there. So it's a little bit different.
Darren, 2018, Scottish Open, Gullin.
Yes, sir.
Friday, you missed the cut. I look at you walking off the course. You say, Damon, I cannot wait to turn 50. I cannot wait to get to PGA Tour Champions. All these years later, have you enjoyed it as much as you thought you would?
Oh, yeah, I love it. You know, our commissioner out here, Miller Brady, does an unbelievable job for us in PGA Tour Championship. He really does. And, you know, you take a look at it, a lot of people think their courses are 6,000, 6,500 yards long, flags in the middle of the green. They're far from it. You know, a lot of the, we used to play about 7,200 yards in greens, running out 13 on the stint, maybe in the flags instead of four off the left or six off the left. The big thing that we don't have is the rough, because obviously, as we get older, we don't have the club head speed to dig it out of the heavy stuff. But, you know, the Champions Tour, we're all, everything's very relaxed and everything's all a lot of fun until we get a Friday morning. And then we're back being tour pros again. And we've known each other for so long. You know, the congratulations that I've had this week, you know, it's genuine from all the fellow pros that are here. You know, we're smaller field events, 78-man field for the most part, until we get to the majors. But everybody's genuinely pleased for each other. That doesn't mean we don't want to kick each other's butt all the time, because we do. But, you know, when you get over the line and you get a win, everybody's genuinely delighted. But the Champions Tour, I'm just delighted. You know, I live down in the Bahamas, down at the Abaco Club in Winding Bay, and then I commute in and out. My wife, Alison, is with me nearly every week, and I just love the opportunity still to practice, to work, to have an opportunity to compete. And one of the things that I said to Ben at the start of last week when we talked on the Tuesday was, listen, we've got a really good chance here. Our goal is simple, is to get into the mix on Sunday afternoon to be in with a chance to win the tournament. And that's what I try and do every week, you know, get in there within four shots of the lead starting on the 10th tee on Sunday. That's what the goal is, because those juices are always there. They're never going to leave you. It's the excitement. That's why we practice. That's why we do what we do.
That's why I love following these guys, because they're all champions and they all are smelling the roses right now. But when it's time to turn on, they click into that tour player mindset. Yeah. You mentioned Lynx Golf.
Yes, sir.
I want to ask you, because next week we're on a Lynx style, mm-hmm. American Lynx style, if you please, golf course. Let's go back to 2011 and the nuance that is Lynx Golf. And mm-hmm. I'm sure you remember this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this was slightly fortuitous bounce, I would have to say. But, you know, sometimes with Lynx Golf, they'll say, and that's a little bit of an over-example. But when your conditions get tough, you've got to use the ground. And you can do that. And you were talking about next week or whatever at Shinnecock, you can use the ground at Shinnecock. You know, I've put it off that, which one's a par three? The seventh green a few times and stuff when it's been so fast. But Shinnecock's that sort of, it's almost a hybrid where you can actually use the ground and chase it in there. And Shinnecock's a wonderful test. It's a fair, hard test of golf. And that's all you can ask for whenever you go into major championships.
Darren, we're told that winning majors changes lives. Mm-hmm. Did it change your mm-hmm. life?
Oh, I lived like one before. I won any anyway. So it didn't really make any difference to me. But no, you know, if I go back and had the choice of one that I wanted to win, obviously being from Ireland, the Open would be the one that I've always dreamt of. You know, all young kids, you know, when coming out and aspiring professionals or whatever, when you turn pro, you're always going the putting green or something and you go, this putt's for the Open, or this chip's for the Open, or that's for the Open. You know, that's just me, or this is for the Masters, or this is for whatever major you want to think, the biggest tournaments in the game. And I'm very fortunate I was able to fulfill that dream at the ripe old age of 42. So, you know, not everybody gets to fulfill their dreams. I did. And, you know, I'm so thankful now that my name is on that trophy and forever will be. That trophy and the Senior Open trophy sit side by side on the entryway into Royal Portrush Golf Club. That's where they remain. If I had them, they'd be in a drawer, so they wouldn't be out anywhere. So they just, you know, a lot of the guests that come to Royal Portrush, they walk in there and they see the two claret jugs sitting beside each other in the display cabinet.
It is very cool to see. Mm-hmm. I can absolutely attest
You're
to that.
Cinematic.
Darren, that day, that Sunday, uh-huh. when you were about to tee it up in that final round mm-hmm. at Royal mm-hmm. St. George's, Dr. Bob Rotella likes to tell me the story about the conversation you guys had in terms of mindset. And I'm bringing it up because I know it can inspire people with whatever major they're trying to win in their life, too.
Yes, most definitely. You know, Dr. Bob, I've worked on and off with Dr. Bob through my whole career. I think he can only stand me for a certain amount of time, and then he goes, I'm really dealing with the madman here, so we back off a little bit. But that week he was brilliant. I'd played really well in Scotland the week before, but messed up on the Sunday. And we got together on the Tuesday of the Open Championship at Royal St George's, and he just got me hitting some putts and getting my mind out of the way, just let me play. Because we all, if things aren't going right, what's the first thing most amateurs go to, or pros or whatever? You go to technique. It's not always your technique that's wrong, it's the way you're thinking is wrong. And Dr. Bog cleared my mind a little bit. And as I was going out, walking to the first tee on Sunday in the last round, going out there to play with Dustin, I looked at Bob and I said to him, I said, Doc, if I can keep my attitude the way it is, it makes no difference whether I win or lose. Now, obviously, it was like to win the opportunity to win the tournament of my dreams was right in front of me. But that's how good mentally I was. I hadn't got ahead of myself at any stage. I wasn't consumed with trying to win. I was consumed with going and keeping my attitude as good as I could and see where I finished at the end of the week. And thankfully, that week, that Sunday, a few things went by my eye, and I was fortunate enough to lift the Claret Jug. But, you know, he's got that thing to me. He says, if you're unflappable, you're unstoppable. And that's mainly just a mental thing. The mental side of the game has never always been my forte, I have to say. I do go at flags that I shouldn't go at, and then short side myself and get annoyed at myself. And one bogey has occasionally led to more. And that's not really the way to play professional golf. But, you know, patience, I was never really gifted with a lot of that either.
Well, led to a three-shot win on that Sunday. Before I let you go, I understand you're putting on your captain's hat again.
Oh, yes.
With Skechers. What should we know?
The Skechers World Champions Cup, December, Heather Sounds, first week in December, Heather Sound down in Florida. Same we've had it this past few years. It's a six-man team from Europe, six-man team from an international team, six-man American team. My other two captains are Justin Leonard for Team USA and Retief Goosen for the international team. Great guys. And it's a round-robin sort of format, you know, Ryder Cup and President's Cup all rolled into one. And you think that you know, it's all a little bit of laugh, a little bit of banter. But as soon as we start representing our teams again, the team thing, team golf, I love team golf. I played rugby growing up, you know, I was a team guy. And I loved it. I had to make my choice at 17. I was going to play rugby or professional golf. I chose golf. Sometimes I wish I'd have chosen rugby, but I chose golf. And, you know, the team things always really appealed to me. That's why I've loved and enjoyed the Ryder Cup so much. And we get the opportunity now again to go back and represent Team Europe again this year. And, you know, Monty said there, was it last year? He said, you know, getting his bag with his name on it again is special. It's just so special. And that the competition is so, it's a system that we're competing against each other, and there's all these points and everything, but yet everybody knows what's going on. And we just want to kick each other's butt. It's such a pride thing. And it's an amazing event, which is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, we need people to come out and watch it. When they see there and they see the emotions, everything involved in the World Champions Cup, I think they'll really get into it and really enjoy it.
Well, that's what Ben Crane said in The Glow of Victory. You can see why Darren Clark won so many Ryder Cups, says you are elite at team golf. You're also elite in interviews, my friend. It's always a lot of fun, man. It's great to visit with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, you boys, for having me on. Thank you.
It's time now for another Golf Today Roundtable. Let's welcome in a couple of GolfChannel.com senior writers and Rex Hoggard from Canada and Ryan Lavner from home. Rex, going to start with you. Happy birthday, my friend. 25 again. Must be nice. You spoke to Brooks Koepka. How did you find his confidence level 1 week out of the U.S. Open?
I think he has a ton of confidence. I don't want to overstate that because clearly we're going to get into his putting, and that's an issue, and it's something that he has been dealing with really all season long. But I'm going to go back to when he returned to the PGA Tour earlier this year at Torrey Pines, and he has made steady progress. And I think there's, as far as his ball striking goes, he's in a really good spot. He knows that. It's his putting that he needs to come around. It's been spotty. He's had some decent weeks. The Cognizant Classic was a decent week. He made a putter switch last time around when he played last at the Nelson. So I think he's fighting it. I think he's getting there, and he knows he's close.
All right, I'm going to ask, I'll start with Lav on this because I know Rex is going to want to weigh in on it too. But Lav, with the U.S. Open right around the corner, where do we go for storylines? If you were the editor that had to assign what the title's going to be on the front page of the sports section, where would you go?
Well, Matt, I'd love to say the golf course, and keep in mind Shinnecock is the last time back in 2018 that we had an over par winning score. But don't we have to begin and end with Scottie Scheffler and his pursuit of the career Grand Slam? And look, I think we've had more questions about Scottie Scheffler and his game over the past 5 months than we've had over the past 3.5 years combined, just because his ball striking, which is typically peerless, has been, at least at times this season on the PGA Tour, somewhat pedestrian. I don't think that was any more on display than just last week at the Memorial Tournament. Really struggled with his approach play, at least over the first couple of rounds, at least on the weekend, showed signs that he was turning the corner. But he's going to have to be so much more precise at Shinnecock with some of the small shelves that the USGA is going to tuck these pins on to produce a winning score that's most likely to be somewhere around par. We know driving the golf ball, Shinnecock is going to be pretty generous off the tee. We know with Scottie Scheffler's putting and his short game, are very tidy as well, but does he have the ball striking prowess to again become a history making figure in this game and to become just the seventh player to complete the career Grand Slam?
Rex, what's your headline? Is it Shinnecock Hills? Is it Scotty? Is it Southampton, the town?
I think if I'm doing headlines on Monday, Damon, and that's what I'm looking forward to the most, it's going to be Shinnecock Hills. I think, Matt, you said it best yesterday when we were sort of talking about Shinnecock Hills is woven into the fabric of American golf. It is the history of American golf architecture. And then, of course, the recent history. We have seen how the USGA has lost control of that golf course. We have seen how it can aggravate players going up and down the range the last couple of days. Shinnecock Hills is a topic of conversation. They're talking about those wide fairways that Ryan just referred to. However, we know if you're going to miss those fairways, you're pretty much going to be hacking out sideways. I think this is such a compelling test in all of golf. It's one of those places that it's a pillar of American golf. And to have the national championship there, that's the headline.
Hey, Rex, let me stay with you then on this. If that's the headline, is there a risk there for the USGA that this time to not over-engineer the golf course?
I think there is, and there's lessons to be learned from past opens, at least recently past opens at Shinnecock Hills, because you know how easy it is to go over the lot because it's right there next to the ocean, and you want to set it up as close to the line as possible. I know they don't want to talk about even par being the score, but you certainly want to create a test, and if you get anything wrong with the forecast, the way those greens are exposed, the way they can get hard and firm and fast and become unplayable, and we've heard players talk about that in the past, you don't want a situation that you ended up with Phil Mickelson just a few years ago, where it gets to the point where the player makes a bad decision, does something out of frustration. So I think that's the compelling part of this. But you would hope, you would think that after all of these years and all of these bad headlines, the USGA would learn their lesson.
Well, Lav, we saw 43 players punch their tickets to Shinnecock Hills via golf's longest days, Monday and Tuesday. What was the biggest headline and takeaway for you?
At least personally, Damon, again, I was in Georgia about an hour north of Atlanta at Hawks Ridge. And, you know, I've been doing this for a decade now for golf's longest day. And I was really struck by the dichotomy between a couple of players and fascinated by the expectations. So Chris Kirk, a six-time PGA Tour winner, was the medal, the medal winner at our qualifier. And I asked him afterwards, I said, as being a six-time PGA Tour winner, how does that experience help you in sort of this one-day shootout? And he sort of dismissed it, and he said, as a six-time PGA Tour winner, I know that I'm good at golf, and that should help me in a 36-hole qualifier like that. And he wasn't bragging. He wasn't being overly complimentary of his own game. It was just the facts. Like, as a PGA Tour player, he was approaching this like he should win, and if he doesn't win, he should at least finish among the top five. On the other end of the spectrum, we also had a player in Chase Kyes, who was a top-ranked junior player. He's a rising sophomore now at Tennessee, and he went semi-viral after the interview because he admitted that he didn't even know that the U.S. Open was next week at Shinnecock. And here's a player who simply entered the qualifier, was going to show up and try to play his best, and whatever happens, happens. I don't think that's necessarily the wrong approach or mentality either, but like afterward, he put his hands on his head like, holy, how? What's happening? What did I just do? And now all of the logistical issues and how am I going to prepare for this? And who am I going to be playing with? And am I ready for this sort of test? All of those things sort of entered in his mind, after he signed his card, after he did the interview, which again came just a couple minutes after signing his card. So I was very fascinated by the expectation level for PGA Tour players and players who probably didn't get this far in their dreams.
Yeah, it was amazing. And not to mention how many amateurs ended up asserting themselves on golf's longest day, some of whom were, 17 years old? It was mind-blowing. So, Rex, I want to pick up on something that Lav gave me an idea of, because a couple questions ago,
he mentioned about questions, and we had posed the question about what's your headlines. But what do you think the biggest question marks are coming into this U.S. Open? We already talked about Scottie Scheffler. What about the rest of the field?
Do you have the patience to withstand that test? And I think that's a question that you could probably ask every player in the field starting next week. It was interesting. I just did an interview with Colin Morikawa, and we worked our way back around to patience. We know what Colin Morikawa has gone through this season. He got off to a hot start, wins a signature event at Pebble Beach, and then whatever happened to his back or neck at the Players' Championship, it's really been difficult for him because he knows he can play well. He knows he's not going to hurt himself anymore, but the way he explains it, has a hard time trusting himself. And I asked him specifically, how has your patience been tested? I'll go to next week, and we can probably ask every player in the field after every single round, maybe after every single shot, how is your patience tested? And we'll end up with 156 different answers. I love that idea because normally, week in and week out, players, these top players, at least on the PGA Tour, can come out to a golf course and they know reasonably what to expect. They can keep their expectations low. At the U.S. Open, that's thrown out the window.
Lav, a lot of people lately watching CNBC to check out that SpaceX IPO. But if you watched yesterday, you saw the LIV Golf CEO, Scott O'Neill, saying he would not guarantee that the four remaining LIV Golf events would take place. But he said, you know, we would be a good investment should you want to invest. What did you take away from his comments?
Yeah, a couple takeaways. I think it certainly underscored the point that at least the back half of this LIV Golf season is uncertain, even if to this point they have the assurances from the Saudi Public Investment Fund that they are funded through the remainder of 2026. It probably was smart on Scott O'Neill's part not to guarantee that those four tournaments are going to go off without a hitch after he was hoodwinked by the Saudis pulling the plug and completely undermined him as a leader. I thought, as you mentioned, the more curious statement was what I can guarantee is a heck of a return if you come to invest in this business. I don't know how you could possibly make that guarantee at this juncture. The Saudi PIF and one of the world's wealthiest sovereign wealth funds poured more than $5 million into this business. They saw this as a long-term project, but instead they pulled the plug because they did not see an immediate and short-term path to viability. So for Scott O'Neill to say that after, again, not guaranteeing that these four tournaments are going to go off, was certainly a head-scratcher.
Now, I don't like to correct my podcast partner here because he hates it when I do it on our podcast. However, it's $5 billion with a B, Lab, not $1 million with an M. That's a vastly different sum of money.
Certainly a B,
I think it's a couple of things we need. Yes. I know your bank account probably starts with a B, but mine starts with an M. So let's just go with that and make it clear on that front. I will say on two fronts, Scott O'Neill is in a really difficult spot here because, A, he's trying to sell this tour, and you need to get out front. You need to be very public. But, B, he put himself in a weird situation, having to answer questions that he clearly doesn't have answers for. And I can tell you on the range behind me, there is a lot of whispering about what may come next, about a lot of young players on LIV Golf are clearly looking ahead to what's next, because if they finish up this season and he doesn't get that investment, then they have to start looking ahead to the DP World Tour and eventually the PGA Tour. And it's probably best in a lot of these young players' mind to get that clock started sooner rather than later. And by that, I mean we have seen it firsthand with Patrick Reed this season. He left LIV Golf at the end of last year. His contract was up. He went to the DP World Tour, got off to a great start. It seems like he's going to be one of those top 10 players to lock up a tour card and earn his PGA Tour card for next year. So essentially, he is spending that year, which you're going to have to serve a year suspension, for lack of a better term, from the time you play your last LIV event to the time you can start playing on the PGA Tour again. If you're a young player, like a Joaquin Niemann, you're probably thinking to yourself, why wouldn't I start that clock sooner than later?
Lev, I'll start with you on this one, too, because there isn't a tremendous amount of clarity on the PGA Tour side either. After the U.S. Open, Brian Rolapp is expected to speak at the Travelers to give us all an update on what's going on. What do you expect?
Well, look, Brian Rolapp said last week at the Memorial Tournament, according to the reporters who were there, that we have a lot of work to do in the remaining 3 weeks to make sure that I have something that is substantial to tell everyone who's going to be listening at the Travelers Championship. You remember back at the Players Championship, he said, look, we've got some work to do. This is the outline for the future. We want to go to big markets. We want to start big. We want to be on the West Coast. We want to have this two-track, two-tier system to have the superstars and the players who are going to be fighting for status. It's unclear at this point exactly how substantive those discussions and those plans are going to be outlined by Brian Rolapp. He's put a lot of faith in the PGA Tour Policy Board and the Future Competitions Committee that they can do the work necessary over these 4 months between the players and the Travelers Championship to really make this thing launch. But keep in mind, a year ago, Brian Rolapp at the Tour Championship, this was all supposed to be geared towards 2027. They've already basically punted on that timeline for most of the key components of this looking at 2028. It has certainly been harder for Brian Rolapp to have his vision for the PGA Tour cemented than he probably realized a couple months into the job.
Rex, can you hear us okay? Jump in.
I think the problem that Brian Rolapp probably faces on this one is the devil's in the details, as we all know, and we're experiencing that firsthand. We had a chance to talk with a couple of players, Corey Connors. I'm going to talk to Nick Taylor this afternoon. This is something there's no way he had ever thought about was going to be an issue. If an event like this, the Canadian Open, is not a Tier 1 event starting in 2028, if we do move to this schedule, if it's a Tier 2 event, what do you tell the Canadians, who are all mostly Tier 1 players? Corey Connors certainly is. Nick Taylor certainly is. Mackenzie Hughes, you can keep going down the list. Now, according to our colleague, Eamon Lynch, they're going to be strongly discouraged from playing Tier 2 events. But I can tell you, speaking with the Canadians in the field, that's not going to work. So here is a problem that I'm sure Brian Rolapp never even envisions. And it gives you an idea of exactly how complicated this is. I think Lav is 100% correct. Brian Rolapp is going to go into this meeting on Monday night of the Travelers Championship, and he's going to try to get something done. But I don't think anything's locked in as of right now.